This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
And good morning. We will be talking about the historic Fair Work Commission ruling that Australia's largest retailers and mining companies and manufacturers and all down the line of logistics will now be forced to pay truck drivers more to compensate for those spiralling fuel costs. And I want to know from you, are you happy to face those higher costs? Because almost inevitably, it will come through to consumers, particularly, though, in the light of how much truckies have been bearing the brunt of the fuel crisis across the world. It has been an unhappy few months for the truckies who have been bearing the brunt of the fuel crisis and the soaring costs. Well, the Fair Work Commission has made a ruling described as historic that will force Australia's largest companies to pay truck drivers more to compensate. And, of course, that's good news for truckies. The unions were saying that many operators were on the brink of collapse. Some refinancing their homes, it was said, to fund their petrol bills. So I'm asking you, if you're a truckie, how are you feeling this morning? Are you relieved? What have you been going through? And is this fair enough, this ruling? If you are not a truckie, are you happy to face the higher costs, maybe even the higher interest rates that this ruling at scale could affect? It's said to be effectively going to influence all parts of our economy. We'll get analysis about that. But what do you think? Are you happy to pay those higher prices? We're going to talk to, as I say, an analyst about this ruling and also the owner of a truckie business as well. We've seen the rates of Australians with second languages tumbling over the decades. But now with these shifting tides of geopolitics, that need to be connected, to have that insight with other countries, has been heightened. And we're going to be talking today with an expert about the languages our kids should be learning. I learned French myself because that was deemed, well, I liked it and it was deemed important at the time. But then, a decade on or so, Japanese was the thing to learn. Then Mandarin, Arabic has had its heyday. They follow, of course, the shifting politics and the economic tides. I'd like to know what language you learned and has it been useful? We will get to that this hour. And, of course, yes, I am going to wade back into the AFL Tribunal. We went down into the weeds last week and over the past 8 days, we have seen this case that's made the AFL Tribunal seem a little bit like it's gone from, let's say, the seriousness of a court to the Supreme Court, maybe, to Keystone Cops. Maybe that's too harsh. But do cast your mind back when we did talk last week. The Butters case was all about the principles of justice when a player comes up against an umpire, player's word against his. In the end, though, what scuppered the case is that one of the jury members had to disconnect from his laptop to his phone in the car, and that's because his day job required it. Full sympathy for tribunal members if they have something to do for their day job, but does it mean that the AFL Tribunal does need an overhaul? I'd love to hear from you. Also this hour, Apple's got a new boss. Tim Cook is gone. John Ternus is in. Now, what does that mean for you and me? Like it or not, this company plays a huge role in our lives, way beyond the squares in our pockets. Even if we don't have one of the Apple rectangles in our pockets, the tech bros are like the new oligarchs in at least America, and they have the ear of the US president. They influence policies around way more than just the tech in those phones, about privacy, about data, about regulation, about the future. So we will dig into that and see what Apple's new boss has got going for him, what it could mean for you and me. Is it fantastic that truckies will get more support with fuel prices? That's next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So, companies like supermarkets and Amazon and really right across the board have been ordered to review their fuel prices in a Fair Work Commission order being described as historic. And what that effectively means is that that will be helping out the truck transport companies, as well as sole operator drivers and subcontractors as well. Joining me now is Leonie Carter, who's CEO of Carter Heavy Haulage. Thanks for joining me, Leonie.
No, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
What's your reaction to the ruling?
I've actually been involved with this over the past 4 weeks. It's Fair Work Commissioner should be congratulated for working so quickly to come to this resolution. But let me make it clear for yourself and the listeners that this is not a money grab for truckies in our industry. This is a cost of fuel recovery. In February, we've seen our diesel bulk prices at around the $1.50, $1.60 mark. As soon as the war began, they jumped, and we were paying prices up to $3, and I think they peaked at $3.30. So it's not us profiting as a transport industry, it's us recovering our costs. But consequently, that cost then has to be passed on to our clients, which will then pass it on to our consumers. That's going to affect a broader range, from groceries on the shelf, to building supplies and things that get manufactured, right across to road repairs even. It's all fueled by diesel, and the cost of diesel is going to affect every Australian nationwide.
Mm. Is it fair to say, I've read reporting that this affects and will benefit mostly sole operator drivers and subcontractors and family-owned trucking companies, because they're typically paid by companies under contracts that aren't regularly renegotiated? Is that right?
Yeah, it's going to affect the whole supply chain, from owner-operator, small, medium and large corporates. You've got our small to medium businesses that work under contract. It's locked in for maybe a 12-month or a two-year period with a CPI increase. But when you see something like this happen, it's completely out of our control, and we can't absorb those costs. So it will help the smaller businesses, but what it also does with the major contractors, with the Coles, the Woolworths, the Audi, they are locked into a contract as well, and they can't recover their cost. So it's right across the board.
And you are saying it's inevitable that it will hit consumer prices.
Absolutely. We work in the asphalting world as well, and we provide bitumen, liquid and equipment to councils for road repairs and new developments. We've seen that increase 90%. What we've seen over the last 4 weeks is local councils shelve their work that they've got planned because they can't absorb that cost immediately. They have to go back to their directors, they've got to come up with a plan, and then they've got to implement that plan. And consequently, that's going to roll on to our taxpayers and our land holders as well. There will be like a levy for this additional cost. So yes, it's really terrifying for every Australian, and everybody should be fully aware of what's happening.
You're listening to Leonie Carter, CEO of Carter Heavy Haulage. We're talking about this ruling from the Fair Work Commission. You're talking about a levy, and we will be talking soon to Shane Oliver, who's an economist. But have you got an idea, Leonie, as to what scale of levy we're talking here?
No, I don't know, and I haven't had any conversations with councils. I just know the direct cost that I'm passing on to get machinery delivered and liquid, bitumen liquid delivered. As a client, they have to pass that cost on as well. So I know that there's crisis talks at the moment, but that's with every industry, and it's not just a motto. Without a truck, Australian stops, and everything that white goods, clothing, food, building materials, it's all delivered by a truck. The diesel that fuels the truck is gone up. That means everything that we use as consumers is going to increase. Over the month of March, you wouldn't have seen much of an increase on your groceries because the bigger, larger companies couldn't pass on these costs because of this bill. But now they're allowed to. Now they're enforced to. So we will see prices increase.
Mm. You say you're terrified, Leonie, but this from Justin on text, that it's disappointing that this ruling hasn't included farmers and forestry workers. It's great for truckers, but pretty limited.
Correct.
I think what you said is that this is affecting all of our society. Do you suspect that this ruling might lead to other claims?
It should, and we can't forget our farmers. Majority of those large crops are all fueled by diesel. They a lot of them have their own diesel tanks on site. They need trucks to deliver diesel to the farm so they can power their machinery. So yes, it should affect the farmers, but as I'm in the transport industry, and I advocate very strongly for all my fellow truckers out there and companies, and that's my direction was looking at the transport industry. But yes, the farmers need to be included in this as well.
And just to finish, Leonie, what effect do you believe that this will have on truck drivers? As I said, the unions before the commission were talking about the great personal costs that they've had to bear. How much does this ruling actually flow through to the drivers?
The drivers themselves, our drivers are well looked after. Our truck drivers are well looked after. It is small operators that are owner drivers who are then classed as a company. So it is very emotionally, it's been emotionally straining out there to deal with this so rapidly. The cost is breaking people. We have seen people park up because they simply cannot afford. The other thing that I'm advocating for is payment term reform, because we're doing this work in like today and we're not getting paid for the work that we do for 30, 60, 90 days. So that's another thing that I'm advocating strongly for, is to bring the payment terms into a line with the current cost of what we're paying up front. So it puts a big pressure on cash flow. And that's right across the board as well, from smaller operators to larger corporates. So it is really unsettling, and it's a very important space that we need to keep our eyes on.
And so for that reason, Leonie Carter, I'm grateful for you giving us an insight.
No worries. Thanks for your time.
That's Leonie Carter, who's CEO of Carter Heavy Haulage. Well, what sort of domino effect will this have? Shane Oliver is the AMP Chief Economist. Hi, Shane. What do you think is going to happen from this ruling?
Well, I think what will happen is what most economists assume would happen, and that is that we have seen a big rise in fuel costs, particularly diesel, but we also know petrol. That's been slightly offset by the excise tax reductions, but it's still a big rise. Most economists, like myself, are just assume, well, that will lead to higher costs throughout the economy. Transport costs, I think all of us have seen signs of a fuel levy. In fact, I got an email from my local hardware saying that they were putting up the costs of deliveries from the hardware as a result of higher fuel costs, and that was about 3 or 4 weeks ago now. So I think it's something that we've been seeing coming through. This ruling is really just a part of the mechanism by which that occurs, and in this case here, particularly owner drivers who had fixed contracts for certain time periods and then will suffer a huge loss given the higher fuel costs that they're now facing compared to when they signed up the contract. But whichever way you cut it, there's going to be a flow on to higher prices in the economy over and above just the rise in petrol and fuel prices. There's that flow on higher transport costs. That means higher costs in the supermarket. And of course, all those other prices which are impacted by oil, basically, like fertilizer and plastics. And
it must have an inevitable effect on inflation then.
It certainly will, and that's why there's so much talk about stagflation. Last week, of course, it depends when who puts out a report when. Last week, of course, all the excitement, and this is not good news, I shouldn't be laughing, it's actually bad news, but all the excitement last week was about recession, but following the IMF's comments. But the reality was that it's stagflation we're talking about here, and that is a very painful thing. Stagflation is something we last saw in a big way in the 1970s, and it was partly due to supply shocks at the time. So when you have a supply shock, it means you can't do the same amount of economic activity as in the past, but you also see higher prices. So you end up with lower economic growth, higher unemployment on the one hand, but higher prices on the other. Now, a central bank like the Reserve Bank can look through a rise in oil prices or petrol prices, just like they can look through a rise in fruit and vegetable prices due to bad weather. Providing it's not going to show up in higher prices generally. And unfortunately here, there is a risk that likelihood, as we're talking about, it will show up in higher prices generally. So it means a pretty painful period for the economy.
Shane, to sum up, do you think it's inevitable also that it'll have an effect on the interest rates?
It probably will. Look, this sounds horrible and tough, but the 1970s experience told us that the central bank really has to focus on getting inflation back down. If we don't do that, and we just cut interest rates because of the hit to economic activity and risk of recession and ignore the rise in inflation, then inflation likely gets locked in at higher levels. Mm. People will demand higher wages because they see the prices going up. Companies will then put their prices up. We end up with a wage price spiral. That's what we had in the 70s. And that's what the Reserve Bank, I think, is worried about and warning about, and probably why they'll end up hiking interest rates again. And it also makes it really tough for the budget because, you know, we've got a budget coming up. If they pump too much stimulus into the economy
exactly.
to protect people, then that could just add to more inflation and lead to more pain. And also the reality is, and this sounds kind of harsh, but all Australians suffer from high inflation. But as we go through this, most of us will keep our jobs. So you've got to get that trade-off right, that if you let inflation get out of hand, all Australians end up hating the Reserve Bank or the government.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just let unemployment go up a little bit, the pain is not quite as bad. But ultimately, the reason you want to control inflation is so that ultimately you can keep unemployment down. But
indeed.
There is a short-term trade-off.
Between
there.
A rock and a hard place, we find ourselves. Shane Oliver, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Marita, you've called from Anglesey.
Oh, yes. Thank you. It seems that so we attend to one crisis and then it costs the economy and the budget respectively and then resume the torpor until the next crisis that has to be mitigated.
Mm. What do you think should happen, Marita?
Yeah. Well, it needs an absolute overhaul to reverse the eviscceration that began with Hawke Keating of transferring rail rates to road transport. We need an absolute reversal of that. Moreover, we wouldn't be in such a crisis if we had a better freight service instead of road on the trains rather than road.
Rail freight, yes, has often been touted as the way to have that resilience proofing. Thank you, Marita. And this as well on text, will this roll back when the petrol prices go back down? Andy says, can the big supermarkets not absorb some of the costs instead of passing them on to consumers? It sounds like it's going to go way down the line. We'll keep that conversation going throughout the conversation hour on 774 ABC Melbourne. We will also be talking about Apple's new boss. We will be talking about whether the AFL Tribunal needs an overhaul. But coming up next, what second language did you learn? Have you found it useful? And what languages should our kids be learning now?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Angela says that she studied Japanese at school from 1994 to 2000, then for another 3 years at Melbourne University, lived and worked there in 2007. So worthwhile, even though I haven't used it much since then. Tell me about your second language and why it was important to you. Whether you're encouraging your kid to learn a second language, what should it be? Kylie Farmer is Vice President of Language Teachers Victoria and is on the executive of the Australian Federation of Modern Language Teachers Association. She joins me now. Hi, Kylie.
Oh, hi, Mary. Thanks for the opportunity today.
We know that the rates of Australians learning second languages is way down historically, presumably because, I guess, future generations of migrants didn't keep up their languages. What's the situation like now?
It's such an interesting space, and it's always so many factors which influence the learning of languages. Very different across this country. It's different states and territories experiencing different challenges and opportunities and interests in particular languages. And I guess focusing on Victoria, we're really fortunate here to have so many languages available to our students and a really strong retention of students right through to year 12. So we're pretty fortunate here. Even though there's challenges, we would like to always increase the number of students who have the opportunity to engage with languages.
Mm. I was talking before about the economic sort of tides that mean that parents will say, oh, you'd better learn Japanese because all of the jobs are going to be there, or you'd better learn Arabic because, you know, the world means that Arabic will be more important. How do schools choose languages, and how should students choose languages?
Yeah, it's great in Victoria that we actually teach over 50 languages, both through from early childhood in our kindergartens, schools, through community languages, and through the Victorian School of Languages. So there's plenty of choice available, whether students are accessing it out of school hours, and that's often through personal interest. If the language they're interested in isn't offered in their school, they might attend a weekend program or a out-of-school program. Some of these are offered by communities who really are very passionate about making sure their future of languages is strong in their community. So students can choose, but schools also make choices about the languages they offer. Many factors influence this. Schools must provide students with the opportunity to learn a language from the start of school right through to year nine. And obviously then it becomes an elective. We hope students will continue to take right through to year 12, but we recognise there's many factors that will influence whether they do that. Sometimes they don't have the space in their program to do everything they'd like to at year 12, but they might come back to that language or choose an additional language at tertiary level. So it's varied.
Varied, yes, whether it just ends in, you know, those year six displays of, I don't know, Irish or Italian dancing or whatever versus, you know, a whole career and living overseas. 1300 222 774, I'd love to hear from you where learning a second language affected your life, maybe opened up your horizons and how important it was for you. Sarah in Moonee Ponds, you learned French, is that right?
I learned French in high school, and it certainly helped me. I just love the way it changed my brain and just opened up my world to meeting new people. And then I've had three children of my own, and I've encouraged them to learn other languages. My third child is the one who's taken it up.
Mm-hmm. What are they learning?
He's learning Japanese.
And did you influence that choice, or was it even just the love of languages that you passed to him, do you think?
I'd like to think that it was just something in him, because he just started learning with the Duolingo before he even got into high school.
Yeah, and Duolingo is a recent discovery of mine. I also learned French, Sarah, and spent some time over there and was even thinking in French at a certain point in my life. It lay dormant, but then Duolingo really did reactivate the brain. Are you doing the same?
Yes, I am.
Good on you, Sarah. This will be music to the ears of Kylie Farmer, who's been listening in. What do you think of Sarah's experience there, Kylie?
I just love that understanding that there's so many benefits beyond what we typically might recognise why we learn a language. It's sometimes seen as an economic benefit or something like that, but we really see that the bigger impact this can have on brain development, literacy skills, communication, doorways being opened, not just to the speakers of that language that you might have learnt, but having an understanding of there's different ways of communicating and being and cultural understanding. So it's building that sense of understanding, really important in our world today. Doesn't matter what language you've learnt, you'll have skills that you can transfer to other languages and building those connections.
So indeed. And I agree with Sarah. It really almost does, it makes you think in a certain way, because language, of course, and the concepts of language do are very different, even if English and French are actually not that different grammatically. It does make you think differently. This from Louise in Elwood. French was compulsory in the 50s and 60s, and people would wonder why French. It's the second language of the Pacific and Africa after English. Not a waste of time at all. Spanish and Mandarin are the most spoken worldwide, so we should concentrate on these. I'm sure a lot of people would assume that Louise is right, that that's how schools and even people choose languages. From your point of view, as part of the Federation of Modern Language Teachers Association, what do you believe is the role of minor or less common languages and the usefulness of learning them?
Yeah, so I think there's great choice available, which is important for schools in terms of identifying teachers that they're able to employ to offer those languages. And really what we emphasise is all language learning is valuable. Whether it is an emerging language, like Hindi and Punjabi are quite recently now being taught in Victorian government schools. So that's a more recent development. Spanish has also been a fairly recent increase in terms of the number of students learning Spanish. So it's actually the language learning itself is valuable. Which language? There's so many possibilities and factors that influence what is possible. But we open the door to language learning through starting with one language, and students will take their language learning journeys in all many directions through their lifetime. And it is a lifetime of language learning that we're really wanting to support and encourage.
And Kylie, just lastly, I'm just going to put something to you that just came in on text. Language in primary school ends up as a cultural learning rather than language. What would you say to that concept, and whether, you know, that is something that people just leave at primary school age, and that, and whether or not that was actually of benefit?
Yeah, a key point at primary school is the limited time available for teaching languages. We would love to see more time and more frequency of lessons through the week so that students really get that strong foundation in language learning, which learning a language needs time and frequency of engagement with that learning, so that they can have meaningful, successful and build confidence in their skills to learn a language, so that it does go beyond. And really, the influence of the focus of the curriculum now is very much on language learning, building oral interaction, communication skills.
Has so much
more in the past was a bit more cultural activities, but that's not the focus now. It's really communication.
Fascinating to hear how it's changing. Kylie Farmer, thank you.
You're welcome.
Kylie Farmer is on the executive of the Australian Federation of Modern Language Teachers Association. Jill in Preston, you studied French as well. Seems like we're getting together. They're francophone. Hi, Jill. Yes. Has it been good for you?
Oh, look, it's well, that's it. It's had a profound influence on my life. I became a French teacher after studying at uni. Met a fellow at uni in the French club at Melbourne Uni, and we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of our first date.
Oh, awesome. You've been to France much?
I've only been to France once.
Oh.
And yeah, that was back in 1977 as backpackers. We've been to Canada as well. And yes,
it does take you other places. Jill, I love that story. I love that you're emphasising that, yep, the second language just can bring you even more than that second language. This on text, 60 years ago I learnt Latin. Useful for the occasional quiz show, I suppose. Yes, very good. Next, we're going to be talking about, yes, that AFL Tribunal case.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Yes, we are talking about the Zach Butters case. It was thrown out last night. Last week we were talking about how the AFL Tribunal works. This one was thrown out in the end, not because of what actually happened on the field, but because one member of the Tribunal had some problems joining or rejoining the Tribunal hearing. To talk about this, I'm joined by Jack Anderson, Sports Law Professor, Uni of Melbourne. Thanks for joining me, Jack.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
When we last talked, it was all about, well, who should be believed, a player versus an umpire, there's no evidence. And in the end, something very different scuppered this case.
Yes, in the end, it actually had nothing to do with either Zach Butters or the umpire in question. It had to do with how the initial tribunal was run. And the initial tribunal was run online, which is fairly typical now of sports tribunals, particularly in Australia, where the distances are so large. And the accusation made by Port Adelaide is that during the course of it, one of the tribunal members, because they had another appointment waiting, logged off from a laptop, relogged on a phone, and during that time didn't hear everything that was said, even though it was repeated afterwards. And that was appealed, and therefore on a very narrow, what they call error of law, the appeals board said, look, there was an unfairness there. This equates to what Port Adelaide called a miscarriage of justice, and the case was thrown out.
Mm. The AFL is going to go away and think about this. In your opinion, what needs to change?
Yeah, first of all, I suppose a fundamental question that you have to ask here is, did this matter need to go to a tribunal in the first place? Mm. Once it goes to a tribunal, it's very adversarial. It's one word against the other. But is there another way that you could have done it, be it mandatory mediation or simply sitting the parties down to discuss the matter? So that's the first thing. And maybe that's something in the future that the AFL will consider, that before things go to a tribunal and there take on a life of its own, maybe there are other ways softer conciliation mediation ways that you could do it.
And you're talking for only certain types of offences?
Absolutely, only certain types of offences. There are some offences that are clearly so serious that they would have to go to the tribunal, but there are others that may not, and that may be something to look at. Because the second point then is, once you go to the tribunal, it's extremely adversarial. Both sides are typically now legally represented by senior legal representatives, KCs, etc. You have legal people on the panel itself, assisted by former players, and it becomes very adversarial and legalistic. And I wonder, is that another thing that you could look at? Does it need to be that legalistic?
Indeed, Jack. I mean, this case does highlight the tension between having a highly adversarial system and a way of conducting those sessions, which seems ad hoc if you are, you know, moving around between your house and your car.
I suppose that's the one. The first thing about the legalistic point is, what is interesting about here is that the players themselves are employees. They're very well paid employees, but they're valued very highly by their clubs. So it's not kind of unusual that when they go into a tribunal, the clubs want them properly, legally represented. But that means that those tribunals, therefore, have to be run to the highest procedural and legal safeguards. And in this case, what the appeals board said is, well, when one member logged out, for a temporary period only, that invoked an error of law. But I suppose, look, and it's important to note this as well, the actions temporarily of one person in one matter do not necessarily cast doubt on the AFL tribunal as a whole. The AFL tribunal does a lot of cases and it manages them pretty well. But there may be one or two tweaks that you need to learn from this example going forward.
Mm. You're listening to Jack Anderson, who's a sports law professor at the University of Melbourne. Jack, we're talking there about the long-time tribunal member, former Essendon player Jason Johnson. He did say that he actually was in touch with the main points of the case in doing it. But he had to drive to an appointment. There would be some sympathy for Jason, who's got a day job, who's got a job that pays him, to have to go and meet those requirements. There's a lot of confusion, isn't there, about how much AFL tribunal members are paid and how much weight, therefore, they should be giving these tribunal hearings versus, you know, the pressures of their real lives.
Yeah, and I mean, in some ways, you know, whether the tribunal members are voluntary or whether are paid, there's certain fundamental things that the AFL Appeals Board said that needs to be done, and they need to hear the case as a whole and as one. And in this case, look, there was an error of law, and that's to be regretted, and the AFL has apologised for that. But and I suppose the kind of broader point that you're making then is an important one. With the AFL Tribunal, if you think of it, at the weekends, they would have up to 9 days. They review those games to see whether or not certain instances should be penalised and or go to the tribunal. And then they have to hear the tribunal matters within, you know, 24 or 48 hours. So it's a very, very condensed, quick period in which they have to give written decisions, etc. And generally, it works pretty well. And there has been an incident here. But it may be another point to make that maybe they need to take a little bit more time. Maybe instead of a Monday or Tuesday hearing, leave it until later in the week.
Oh, I don't think the coaches would like that very much.
The coaches mightn't like that very much, but then do we have to have a system where there is an appeals which drags on further? So, and I think the point that the appeals body made yesterday implicitly is, let's get it right first time.
as I said, there's not much transparency around specific pay rates for AFL Tribunal members. Do you think there should be? Do you think there needs to be a bit more discussion about how the AFL Tribunal is set up and therefore what sort of service it can offer to the game, to the clubs, to the players?
Yeah, I actually think, you know, their regulations are publicly available. I think it runs like other tribunals do as well. They review matters like a prosecution. They recommend that things go to the tribunal and then they hear it. So it's not so much that. What I do think, though, is that a lot of the criticism that we've heard of the AFL Tribunal this week is, oh, it's too adversarial, it's too legalistic. But is that not what the clubs want? Mm. I mean, or do they want their players to go in unrepresented? And if it's going to be informal, how does that work? So there may be a consultation piece has to be done with the clubs, with the Players Association, about reform.
And ironically, I was talking off air to Bob Murphy, of course, 774's breakfast hero and AFL legend. In his mind and my mind, decades ago, back in the day, the Tribunal was an even more serious affair. There were just all the ties and the suits and were one place at the AFL. Modern life has meant that it has become remote and so forth, but do you think it's almost like the means of communication, the remoteness and so forth, has made everything a little bit too much, too loosey-goosey, given the stakes?
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I think generally it works actually pretty well, but there are certain procedural safeguards that, you know, that you must abide by. Unfortunately, one of those wasn't in this case, and therefore the case was thrown out. And I think an important point to make about that, whether it's informal or formal, is players don't like to be at the tribunal for sound and obvious reasons. It's not a natural environment for them. Are there things that we can do to support them? But equally, you know, and one of the factors in this as well is that we had an umpire who was adamant that he heard what he heard. And if you look at some of the social media abuse that he got, you'd wonder whether or not sometimes there are ways that we can de-escalate this from the adversarial and public and deal with it quickly, fairly, but maybe privately.
Indeed. How will umpires go, though, by being urged or even told to not take things to reports? Do you think they'll take well to that?
I mean, with mediation, it doesn't have to be in every case, you know. But sometimes what happens, and I think this is an understandable thing, you know, you've got 36 players or whatever, you've got thousands, you've got an earpiece in, there's a lot going on. You know, sometimes your on-field decision on reflection may be the one you mightn't have made, and maybe an opportunity in mediation to tease that out may be the way to go. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes, as you say, clearly, you know, the umpire makes a decision, backs themselves, and off we go. But if there is that little bit extra mediation or conciliation, a less adversarial way of triaging it, maybe we wouldn't have ended up in the situation we are today.
And in the meantime, Jack Anderson, you'd be saying those AFL Tribunal members should just stay on those calls, not get in the car.
Look, you're talking to someone who does a lot of tribunals and does a lot of tribunals online. Stay on the call is good advice.
Jack Anderson, thank you for joining us again today.
Thank you.
Jack Anderson is a sports law professor at the University of Melbourne. Kate has a conspiracy theory about the Butters case. It's texted that this gave the AFL a chance to get Butters off without the umpire losing face and respect. Do you agree with Kate? We were talking about second languages. Lots of texts coming in suggesting Auslan should be included across the board as at least a second language. Cassandra, you've called in from Paran. What do you think?
Oh, look, I'm a big fan of doing second languages. I'm bog Irish background, but at high school I did both Latin and Italian, and I found Latin really useful for learning English grammar. And later in life, I'm now a lawyer. My daughter went to a bilingual primary school. It was bilingual in Vietnamese. She's not Vietnamese. But it was very useful for her to develop her musical ear because it's got more tones than Mandarin.
Oh.
And she now is doing VC and she's doing both Latin and Italian, and she is part Italian. And I just think it's a huge advantage. As an adult, I went and studied ancient Greek and French in Bahasa Indonesia. And I think it's sort of sad that a lot of Australians just don't.
Yes.
Find it interesting.
Cassandra, thank you for leaning in. It sounds like you're doing a lot of heavy sweeping wherever you are, but your love of languages is definitely heard. Thank you for everyone who's joined in on that conversation. It's 12 minutes to 12, and you might have heard Apple's got a new boss. What does it mean? Why is it important for us?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So the news is this morning that Tim Cook is now no longer Apple CEO, that it will be someone else. And to explain why we should be thinking about this, what effect it will have on our lives, I'm joined by Ben Baharin, who is CEO of technology consulting firm Creative Strategies. And he joins me from San Francisco. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about the new boss, John Ternus? Who is he and why? What sort of boss do you think he'll be?
Yeah, so John Ternus has been with Apple around 25 years. He spent the majority of his career there working on hardware primarily. He's been involved in a number of hardware projects as well as launched a couple of products. He's obviously, I think, a bit technical of a CEO, which I do think people are excited about, at least in the market, and he's very well liked in Apple. And so I think, you know, when you look at the transition that's coming, the culture of Apple that's been preserved, it's nice to have a deep bench in terms of executives that are there. And I think this hardware mindset, which also goes along with their head of silicon, Johnny Cerugi, who's now taking a new role also called Chief Hardware Officer, just shows how committed they are to kind of a hardware cycle leg of growth, is kind of my interpretation of that, which I think people are excited about. They want Apple to be innovative. They want them to keep pushing the limits on hardware, and having, you know, more technical product leadership at the helm is what I think everybody is hoping comes out of this transition.
Can you explain for those of us who are definitely not tech nerds why the hardware focus is important? I have seen reporting that describes it, and I don't know if this is meaning the same, that it's someone who's a bit more cautious about the, you know, the stuff they're making versus someone who is innovative. Have I drawn a wrong conclusion that that's what you're talking about?
I would put it more that, you know, a hardware-minded CEO would sort of have a better vision of just what's possible. You know, he's not going to come out and recommend a product that the engineers come back and say, you know, we can't develop that. Mm-hmm. It's stuff that he works in. I think he can have conversations with them about what types of products and really, again, to come alongside them when it comes to executing the vision for product launches. So the market typically really does like technical CEOs for engineering type companies, which, you know, I don't want to say Apple's a purely engineering company, but they make very technical products at scale. And there's a lot of engineering expertise that goes into that. So I think then the engineers in the company, the hardware engineers in the company, having someone they can relate to, who speaks their language, who can talk about product vision the same way, and really meaningfully, intentionally develop products together, I think that's going to be, you know, a positive change for Apple.
You're listening to Ben Baharin, who is CEO of technology consulting firm Creative Strategies. He's joining us from San Francisco to talk about the new Apple boss. What do we know about Ternus as a person?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think he's very well liked. We've heard this internally. People really like him. He's well respected. I think the hope is that he is, you know, the kind of leader that Apple wants. He's done a couple of presentations on stage, so we've sort of seen his charisma, and I think that translates well. You know, so I think in general, just knowing that he's well liked within Apple, and then more importantly, that he was sort of grew up in his career in the Apple culture, because I think Apple wants to preserve the kind of the way, their philosophy of doing innovation and engineering. And so having somebody who embodies that culture as well is important to the company.
Apple, of course, is not just a hardware company and a company that, you know, makes phones and computers. From our perspective here in Australia, the tech bros are almost new oligarchs of the US. They carry immense power. They've got the ear of the president, in fact. How do you think that John Ternus will navigate that space?
I mean, I think he's got a good role model in Tim Cook, and You know, I think it's important to point out that Tim Cook is remaining on as chairman. And so I think there's some speculation that he will continue to do some of that geopolitical stuff and kind of run in the middle of that as needed and let John Ternus, you know, run Apple and focus on the product roadmap, the execution of the company's strategy. Obviously, at some time, you know, he may have to take that on if Tim decides to step down from chairman and do something else. But for the short term, we think Tim remains around to help with that role geopolitically. But obviously, you know, in our country, everybody is having to do the kind of things they need to do to work with this administration and make sure that they, you know, get favorable tariffs or taxes or things like that. So it's sort of just the thing all CEOs are doing right now. And I think if he has to do it, he'll be up for the challenge.
Indeed. Last year, Tim Cook, look, he's not alone. As you say, all of that class, if you like, of billionaires have been doing the same thing with the president. But Tim Cook was particularly mocked when he gave President Donald Trump a custom-made glass plaque. It was mounted on a 24-carat gold base at the White House. From Australians' point of view, perhaps seen through a different lens than what you're experiencing there, Ben, as it was seen as cringy. It was seen as something that, you know, shouldn't happen. But you believe it's the price of doing business in the US at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like you said, he's not alone. Obviously, he, you know, he did something that I think not everybody, most people would agree is relatively cringy. But again, right, I think there's unfortunately a playbook that that many CEOs are going through to just really show their commitment to either do business with this administration and or invest in America and do so accordingly, since that seems to be the policy agenda of our current administration.
Can I take that one step further with you, Ben? And I'm not sure how your analysis is on this, but when you've got these billionaires who are getting closer to the president, not just to influence policies and so forth, but also pushing back against regulation, particularly in the AI sphere, what do you believe is the future of that power basis, those tech bros who are acting in this way? What does the future hold for us?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my perspective on that and just looking at sort of how this has played out, you know, in our country through prior administrations is, you know, they do regulation and they obviously, you know, fight for the preservation of their company or their company's strategy. And so a lot of times, right, public, the government's regulation and or participation in helping them in their strategy to either fend off competitors or get an agenda passed has been regularly, you know, sort of the reason why so many big companies have lobbyists and whatnot. So, you know, I think there's two places, right? There's always in open innovation, there's always disruption that happens. You know, my take is always when you fight these kind of things or you want to push regulation, it's because you don't want to be disrupted. But historically, innovation has come from many different places. And obviously, while, you know, I'm in this country and these companies are in this country, it's still a global landscape. And so competition will always reign supreme. Innovation typically wins throughout the cause of the day. So, you know, we're optimistic that the right technologies take place, that power doesn't become too consolidated. And that's where things like open models, open innovation, stuff that's not controlled by one company, especially with AI, as we watch these open models for AI, not just closed models like those of Anthropic and OpenAI, start to seep into the world and into enterprises. We think that's great for competition, and it'll continue to challenge those who do try to keep control of some of these closed source innovations.
It's a fascinating space to watch. Ben Baharin, I'm really appreciative of your time today.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
That's Ben Baharin, who is CEO of technology consulting firm Creative Strategies, joining us from San Francisco there. It's 4 minutes to 12. Before that, of course, we were talking about languages. Many more texts talking about the virtue of Auslan as the second language. We loved learning this on text and spelling the alphabet of kids. I still remember it to this day. Would love to have learnt more. And we were talking about the AFL Tribunal decision or implosion last night on Butters. Mark agrees with Kate's conspiracy theory because, and that was about this all being engineered to save face all round. An umpire's integrity has been questioned. Red card in any sport. The tribunal has done their best to blow it off. It's a disgrace, says Mark. And the matter of payment for AFL Tribunal members is a moot point. As a qualified company director, your legal obligations are the same, whether you're paid or a voluntary member. That on text as well. thank you everyone for joining me in a lot of great conversations today. You can find this again on the ABC Listen app. Write to me as well, conversationhour@abc.net.au. Talk to you tomorrow.